You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus from New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening. I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us this evening. For many people, the idea of philanthropic organizations is a means by for those less fortunate to benefit in some way. And unfortunately, many people have been under the impression, myself included, that any philanthropic cause, the funding and the attention and the focus is going directly to those most need. But that may not always be the case, and that's why my guest this week, Edgar Villanueva, is the author of the new book, Decoding Wealth. And for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Edgar about his research and the work that he's been doing for many, many years, focusing on who does, who really benefits from philanthropy. Is it really the those who most need it, or are other people getting those funds and that attention? Edgar, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
The book is very, two things come to mind. One, very interesting, but also very eye-opening in the fact that, as I said to you earlier, I've always believed that any philanthropic organization, their main purpose, their main goal was to raise funds or reach out to those less fortunate and help them in many ways. But your book uncovers the fact that that may indeed not always be the case, right?
That is right. Philanthropy at its essence, which the word literally means love of people or love of mankind, is a good thing. You know, to share resources, to give to others is, at its core, good. But the philanthropic industry, as it is operating today, there's a lot going on that we have to unpack. We're talking about a $1 trillion industry that is doing some good, but when you look at how all the resources are operating and who is actually benefiting from those resources, there's a lot to question there about the actual net value of the philanthropic industry.
I guess the first thing that comes to mind for myself is I'm thinking, and I'm just thinking of some of the major, the national philanthropic organizations. Obviously, they're going to people who have wealth. They're going to individuals who have the means to donate. But when you have a great wealth, vast wealth, or a wealthy person or organization, and you're asked to donate or you choose to donate, I was always in the impression that you really didn't have much say as to where that money goes. But your book uncovers the fact that, many of these people who ante up great amounts of money do have quite a bit of say as to who and what and when these funds are dispersed, right?
That is correct. You know, I think, you brought up something that I think is very interesting to mention or important to mention, is that we have to ask the question, who has wealth in the first place in this country? we have a historical and a systemic issue at play here in the United States where there has been very intentional policy and accumulated benefits in this country that have allowed for white people to be the group that has been in the position to build wealth in the first place. And so when we look at philanthropy, which is a byproduct of this system that is a little bit, unfair and has been based on a system inequality, philanthropy itself is then a system that is brings that same type of inequality into it. Although there are good intentions there to help others, we by far have a diversity issue where the majority of the folks who have wealth, the majority of the folks who are starting foundations and giving, tend to be white. And as a result of that, the organizations that are receiving the funds are also large white institutions. And so there's a diversity challenge in that, and there's unfairness in a system that's rigged against people living in poverty, especially people of color, who have been marginalized by history and by policy, and now by philanthropy, because we only receive about 8% of the funds that are being distributed through philanthropic endeavors.
I think that you would agree that image comes into play very much so in any type of philanthropic giving, especially you have a very wealthy businessman or a very wealthy family, even an organization, and by doing so, it certainly bodes well for them. It looks well for them in the public eye. So image, at least in my mind, is something that these people want to keep first and foremost out there. Is that look what we did? In spite of having all this wealth, we were willing to share. So what would be the motivation to take some of these organizations or individuals to task and say, hey, look, all well and good, you're willing to come up with, a million, 2 million, whatever it may be. But you've got to realize that it's not going, or you're not, you're not focusing on those who really need it. I'm just wondering if there'd be a pullback on that.
There is a challenge in that. Some would say that call that reputation laundering. And in fact, the very genesis of the philanthropic industry in this country, and folks should know that we don't have an industry like this in other places. The United States is quite unique in the way that our philanthropic industry is structured. It began, over 100 years ago when a company had a major, public relations incident where there was an accident, lots of folks were killed, and they came together and said, hey, we need to do something a PR thing here to make us look better, to get us out of this mess. And that was the birth of sort of corporate philanthropy by making large gifts, doing press releases around that. And that happens all day long. We see that folks who are making money off of, different industries that are harming people, are naming buildings after themselves. So that's been called reputation laundering. And it is something that, you have to wonder, often it's nice for people to get credit. It's okay. I'm fine with that. But the intentions behind why folks want that credit. And the truth is, when we look at giving in this country and who gives, the facts are that the majority of wealthy folks in this country are not philanthropic. We hear about some folks giving gifts here and there and naming buildings after themselves. But the data show that people who are working class or even lower income in this country give away a higher percentage of their income. So it's actually everyday folks who are more philanthropic and charitable in the United States than your millionaires and your billionaires.
Yeah, I've heard that, and I think there's some truth to that. Just anybody that goes to the has a religious affiliation, just any Sunday or whenever there's a celebratory mass or whatever it may be, you notice that the everyday working people are always willing to, put money in the coffer and hopefully, that it goes to the most needy of causes. I want to take just a quick pause and then we'll be right back. You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. This is The Public Eye. I'm Al Vona, your host. My guest this week is author Edgar Villanueva. And because I think I messed up his name early, so I want to make sure I get it right. Edgar is the author of the new book, Decolonizing Wealth. And in it, he really, very eye-opening. And he describes, in spite of what everybody believes, that the major philanthropic organizations, doing so much good. But where is that good going? And Edgar, as I was, reading the book and as we're talking this evening, I'm thinking, seems like every single month, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have donated money to this, donated money to that, blah, 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 blah. He's got a world-renowned name and reputation. The guy can, certainly make a difference in many people's lives. So is that sort of like what you're talking about, that in spite of the fact that there's this vast wealth, that people like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation a very clear or a very, they make demands, in other words, as to where their money's going. And if you don't like it, then they take the money off the table.
That's true, and that's part of the challenge of the philanthropic industry being not as democratic as it should be. You have to imagine, so folks like Bill and Melinda Gates and other millionaires or billionaires or wealthy families who start foundations, they get a major tax incentive to do so. Right. So there's a major benefit. Wealth advisors will tell you if you have that kind of money, you need to start a foundation. You need to do this to preserve and grow your wealth. And so what happens then, that money is put into a foundation or some type of vehicle like a donor advised fund. You get a major tax break. It helps you preserve or build your wealth by doing so. And then you get to dictate where that money goes versus, what if that money had gone into the public system, into our tax system. We, through our democratic process of voting, would then weigh in on whether that money was spent for education or transportation or other safety net services. And so the challenge in all of this is that one single person with a lot of money can say, hey, I'm interested in education, and I think education should be delivered like so. And then they have enough resources to fund and push that agenda through to change how education is delivered in this country. And that's quite dangerous. If there's no accountability or transparency, some of these organizations do not have boards. It is literally a handful of people, family members, who are deciding where those resources go and who benefits from them. And there's a sort of a forced assimilation on the nonprofit sector to align their work and their practices with the thinking of these organizations in order to get those resources.
Something else that you mentioned comes to mind, and that being that it's usually the everyday person, and I mentioned church only because I see that each and every week. But we know that on a regular basis, the average working man or woman in this country, at one time or another, in the course of a year, at least in a year, does help out, whether it be a local food bank or whatever it may be, and always willing to ante up. Of course, it takes thousands of them to equal what one Bill and Melinda Gates check could equal out to. But more importantly, what you were just talking about, I'm thinking of families like the Koch family, a massive amount of wealth. But wouldn't you agree that in order to really understand who's in need, you'd have to come from a similar background? But if you've been, especially second, third generation wealth, they don't know a day without food, a day without heat, a day without a roof over your head. Even if you were to call them to the mat, is what I'm trying to say, how likely is it that these giant, these vast pools of money, if people have never had a bad day, I'm talking about financially, never had to suffer financially, would they ever get the message?
That's a major challenge that's inherent in the system and in this sector, because there is so much privilege and there is so much wealth, and folks are separated and do not have the proximity to communities that you would imagine. There are very few folks sitting on the boards of foundations or starting foundations that come from a background like mine, where my family is still living in poverty. I absolutely believe that those who have been marginalized in our communities, those who come from poverty, have the experience and the wisdom and perspective needed to design the solutions to fix it. But what we have every single day in these large philanthropic institutions are folks who are very privileged, who think they know best. And it doesn't mean that, they don't have a role to play in our communities, or society to help or to give back. But there needs to be some sharing of that power and a recognition that they may not know best. I've called for in my book that foundations should have boards or trustees that are at least majority representation of the communities they aim to serve. When you look at some of the largest foundations in this country, they're comprised of two or three or four family members, like you said, who don't have any real life experience with the issues of poverty. And so it wouldn't be very hard to bring on additional trustees who are actually from the communities, who have a different perspective that could balance out the thinking and the planning and the strategies of these foundations, bringing real-world experience to the table.
Now, you know, you would obviously we can agree that that makes perfect sense. But again, I don't work closely with philanthropic organizations. I know of a few right here in Central Mass. I don't know how they're structured their boards, but I do know human nature, Edgar, and I think you'd agree. If you are the CEO, if you are the chairman of that board, and it's your money that you're handing over, $1 million, $2 million, whatever it may be, it could be $10,000. They're gonna really want a final say. So you've got a challenge, right? You've got quite a challenge on your hands, do you not?
You know, it is a challenge. Some would say that, power is not given over you or ceded, that you have to take it, which is why I think there needs to be some type of legislative interaction or intervention here to push people in that direction. I will say that I think more and more in the industry, people are beginning to recognize it's becoming best practice that having an insular board is not a good thing. It's not good for business. But ultimately, what it comes down to is the question of whose money is it, right? Because it's really easy to say, okay, this is money that my family or that I am putting aside into this foundation. But the truth is, when you open up an account or create a foundation, you are creating a public entity. You're creating a public organization. You are creating an organization that, again, where the resources could have gone into our public tax system, but are now going into this public type of organization, a foundation that is a part of the nonprofit infrastructure. And because of that, I think that foundations should have the same type of expectations that funders put on, traditional nonprofits. It would be unacceptable for an American Red Cross or for like a food bank or a housing organization in our communities to have a board that was insular or only a few people sitting around making decisions. We wouldn't accept that, but we accept that for the other types of nonprofits that are private foundations in our communities. And so, what I'm saying is that, ultimately, I believe when you put that money into a public entity like a foundation, you are giving up power over to the public. Those dollars become public dollars, not your family dollars, because you're getting a tax break for that gift. And so therefore, the public should weigh in on how those resources are deployed.
And I think most people would certainly agree with that. It certainly makes sense. And you're right. Once you've handed it over, it is for public use. You've gotten your tax write-off. But something interesting, and I was thinking this in the back of my mind, and I'm glad you brought it to the forefront, and that is legislation, whether at the state level or the federal level. And I think about that. I think legislation, certain laws being changed that will level the playing field. But again, those same people that are putting up the money through these philanthropic organizations are probably doing a similar thing with local, local legislators, whether it be at the federal level or at the state level. So what would be the incentive for any government body, local or otherwise, to enact any changes when some of these same big donors through their philanthropic organizations are making major political contributions? Kind of becomes a catch-22, does it not?
That is part of the challenge, is that a lot of the same folks who start foundations are also filling the pockets of our politicians and who don't want to make these types of legislative changes in for foundations. One of the rules that comes up quite often for private foundations is we have what's called the minimum payout rule. And this was a law that was passed in 1976 that said, okay, if you start a private foundation, then at least 5% of those resources need to leave the door of your foundation and get to nonprofits. Because what was happening prior to 1976 is that folks would even start foundations and the money would just sit there and earn interest or be invested in private markets and not have any public benefits. The money wasn't even getting to nonprofits. And so in 1976, they passed this minimum payout rule that only 5% minimally was supposed to get out the door to nonprofits. Now, that has become the ceiling for most philanthropic institutions, only 5%. And so there's been a lot of advocacy and campaigns since 1976 to increase that minimum to force foundations to actually give their money away to nonprofits.
Yeah.
And it's been really, really difficult to see that change in legislation because these organizations rally around and go to D.C. and convince lawmakers to not pass that, which really speaks to the root of the problem that I'm getting at in my book, is that ultimately philanthropy, with its incentives, appears to be more interested in hoarding wealth and holding on to its wealth than actually giving the money away. And so when you have 100% of the resources receiving, a charitable deduction, but yet only 5% of that having public demonstrated good, then that's a problem for the public. We're kind of being robbed of that benefit. 95% of those resources are invested in public markets. And then what we know about that is that the vast majority of those investments are often in harmful and destructive industries that are actually not good for people or the planet. And so the net value of philanthropy, when you put all of those variables together, may be less than zero.
Yeah. I mean, it's, so there's no question. There's a major challenge here, and it may not. It may not be surmounted anytime soon. I think you'd agree that it's, there's a lot of work to be done. The average American needs to be more vocal on all of this. But, by and large, people get they get wrapped up and rightfully so with their own personal lives, and to affect change is not always easy. But in the few moments that we have left, I have to ask you, because I do believe, and I think you would agree, that many Americans, you said it yourself, that many Americans are very generous, and it's usually those who have the least to give that will give. But when it comes to these large givings, these organizations and these individuals that can do so much good, because writing one check is equal to 1,000 people writing small checks, does any country do a better job of it than we do?
We in the U.S. have kind of set the standard. Other countries that are beginning to build out a philanthropic industry, like China, often come here to see how we're doing it. So I can't say that there's other countries that do it better. I do think that there is a tradition of giving in a lot of cultures, like the Native American culture that I come from, and other communities of color and cultures who have traditions of giving that are really coming from the heart and the soul, right, where it's really about sharing and understanding the concept of having enough, right? Why should I hoard up wealth and have a scarcity mindset, and when we have so much and we're in the richest country in the world? And so I think it is like tapping into some of these cultural practices and understanding that there is a different way forward. There is a different mindset around giving that we can embrace. And I think our generosity, our spirit of generosity that really undergirds all of this this work that we're talking about, is what we have to tap into and remember that common humanity, right? That we are all related,
right?
That we're in this thing called life together. And if we're going to give resources for public benefit, let's ensure that those resources actually get to nonprofits doing great work, and that they're not invested in harmful and extractive industries, and portfolios. So that's really the bottom line of what I talk about, is really tapping into our spirit of generosity. And I bring in the book my worldview from my indigenous upbringing of how we can see the world different through all my relations, and how we can use money as medicine to actually bring our communities together versus, creating a larger divide between the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, and that certainly is something at play, especially since the pandemic. So many people have lost jobs and have had to refrain from leaving the house. So I think if there was ever a time when the message should go out, it's certainly that this would be prime time to affect some kind of a changes. Again, if people want to, obviously the book is out there and widely available, Decolonizing Wealth, but if people wanted to just google you or get more information about your work, your research, your organization, how might they do that?
We have a website, decolonizingwealth.com, as well on Twitter and Instagram at Villanueva Edgar.
And that way you can learn what Edgar's been working on. This is not something that he just conjured up a few weeks ago or a few months ago. It has been really, Edgar, I would imagine, a thing that you've been very passionate about for a long time. The work that you do, I think it's making a difference. But I think you'd agree that many voices, working together, banding together, makes all the difference in the world. Again, my guest this evening has been Edgar Villanueva, the author of the new book, Decolonizing Wealth. And when he talks about ways of being able to level the playing field. I know that's somewhat cliche, but so that everybody benefits from philanthropic donations and contributions, and that it goes to those who are most in need. Any questions about the broadcast this evening, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can certainly pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you.